Good morning, Colorado Springs. It's Angela Jones, and it's another brighter day in the neighborhood. For those of you joining in on our podcast, you'll see I'm wearing a hat this morning, and I'm going to tip it to my buddy Paul Rutherford, who's joining us here today all the way from Nashville, Tennessee. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, Angela.
So you are one of the newest additions to the Brighter Day Law team.
Yes, very excited. Coincidentally, I'm also the oldest one. So
are you?
I have that distinction.
Well, we like to think of ourselves as seasoned. I like that.
You know? Aged.
Aged fine.
As we say in the spirits industry.
Right. So as we kind of talked about before we went on the air here today, this is a show all about you and you being a man of very few words. I'm going to do my very darndest to get you talking. Just bring it, huh?
Dig it out, Angel.
All right. And so since you brought in the spirit realm, why don't you talk to our listeners today about your passion for bourbon?
Well, it's really a side hobby. But a good friend of mine and I discovered about 15 years ago that we each enjoyed a nice glass of bourbon once in a while. And I live just south of Kentucky, where 80% of the world's bourbon is made.
Right.
And we are within an hour of the Bourbon Trail.
Yeah,
Kentucky Bourbon Trail. So ever since then, we've been hiking up to the Bourbon Trail once a year and visiting the distilleries and learning more about it and determining, you know, which ones we like and all of that stuff. And we've got a group of guys, between 8 and 10 guys, we'll head up and do that. It's a wonderful little way to end the year. We do it the last week of December.
Well, I do remember, and I can't remember what it's called. I think it was Stag or something like that, being sent on a chase or a hunt for some stag here in Colorado Springs. I think there was a special release or something like that.
It was a special request I made of you, and you were a trooper to run around looking for that. And that's what's kind of interesting is folks between 20 and 40 have the market has exploded of bourbons. And it's not long before you figure out that Buffalo Trace makes some of these high-end bourbons that the young folks are running around chasing. And so it's supply and demand, and it's very hard to find the stuff you're looking for now because of all the new market that is out there for it. But anyway, that's a sideline. We do enjoy.
Well, and I actually did tap into like a whiskey distributor friend of mine, and he couldn't get that stuff either, that stag. But I also remember,
You've got to know people. You got to know where to go, and I've got some in my cabinet.
There you go. You're able to score it. Remember I sent you that picture from New Orleans when I saw it? It was in this little tiny restaurant. They had a bottle of it up on the shelf, and I think they were selling it, I don't remember what I told you, it was something like $18 a finger or something like that
for one shot.
It was good. But
well, it's probably one, it's easily one of the top 10 bourbons in existence.
Really?
George Stagg Jr. And George Stagg Sr., both of those are in the top 10.
So what's your favorite bar none, like? I mean, if you have, like, you're the and okay, well, tell me this. Let me ask you a different question. It's kind of related. What's your go-to favorite? You know, like, hey, this is, and I think I know.
Well, you have to distinguish between the high proof bourbons that you might tap into toward the end of the evening or for a special occasion, and just, you know, day to day. Which is more like 80 or 90 proof, maybe 100 proof. And so, you know, I've got a lot of go-tos that I enjoy. Four Roses, Elijah Craig, Woodford. There's all kinds of good day-to-days that are out there at a reasonable price. I feel like I need to charge some wine store for all this information. Maybe Buffalo Trace.
maybe so. But in terms of like,
it's
you know,
dubious expertise to have to be well versed in whiskey.
Hey, well, and that was going to actually be kind of my next question. Other than that, and it is Pappy that's your top choice.
You know, all the whiskey people know about Pappy Van Winkle, which is the you know, the ghost or the unicorn of right. the of the whiskey world. And I have been privileged to sample that quite a few times, and it's very solid. Very
well, see,
solid
and I
stuff.
Like in and I want you, and I know we're kind of tapping into your, you know, sidebar expertise yeah. here, but I wanted to see if you could kind of explain, because not that Colorado isn't, because we're, you know, primarily here in Colorado Springs, but not that Colorado doesn't have its own, you know, very, you know, fine whiskeys, especially mm-hmm. there's people who are out there, but really we're noted for beer, microbrews and things mm. like that. And then in the Kentucky and Tennessee area, it's bourbon and whiskey. And a lot of times people don't know the difference between bourbon and whiskey.
Oh yeah. Well, all bourbon is whiskey, but mm-hmm. not all whiskey is bourbon. To be bourbon, technically, it has to be at least 51% corn mm-hmm. in the mash bill, which is the recipe.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it has to be aged in a new white oak barrel.
Mm-hmm.
A few other little rules and regulations, but those are the main ones. And then the other parts of the recipe would be things like rye, wheat,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Other grains like that. And, you know, some of them really know how to put it together, and others yeah. are not quite as good. But yeah, Colorado has the Breckenridge label that's mm-hmm. really fine.
It really is.
Bourbon.
Yeah, I think we had some of that over at Elway's that a couple years
yes,
ago. Something
that was
like
a great
that.
Night.
That was good. It was my, I think it was my 50th birthday. I think it was. It was a couple years ago.
I'm surprised you don't even look 50 yet. So, I mean, that's...
Well, it's not from clean living. I'll tell you that. Anyway, so I wanted to cover that. And I also wanted to talk about some of the other things. I mean, a lot of times people think, when they think Nashville, they think country music. And you're a musician in your own right. And I know you're real humble about that, but...
Well... When they think Nashville, I wish they would think great restaurants,
mm-hmm.
a lot of history.
True.
We got a lot of presidents that lived in Nashville one time or another. We've got wonderful architecture, great old neighborhoods.
Sure.
The music is, of course, it's Music City, USA.
Yeah.
So any given night, you can find live music that to appeal to anyone's palate.
Right.
And from blues to roots music to classic country to new country to classical. I mean, everything's there.
Everything.
So it's a wonderful place. Excuse me. Wonderful place to go for music. I was born in Nashville a long, long, long time ago when they had horse and buggies and, you know, a dirt road running through it.
Through downtown.
Yeah. But it's to see the growth that we've had. Is just incredible. The diversity we have, the universities, the hospitals, mm-hmm. it's an incredible city, and it's grown by leaps and bounds and every year. It's a really fun place to be, as evidenced by on Saturday night. I mean, it looks like the redneck Mardi Gras. Yeah. I mean, you've got, it just explodes on Saturday night.
I think
night.
It's now the, you know, like, what do you call it? The stag night and what they call that bridesmaid party.
Yeah,
it's been
a lot of that. My
it's
wife
been a
and
long
I ran
time
an Airbnb
since, yeah.
for a couple of years there, and we had a lot of that and, you know, no empty nights. A lot of people coming to visit.
Lots of glitter.
And keep on coming.
Absolutely.
You're welcome, y'all.
And, yeah.
We'll come on in. We'll leave the light on, fix you a plate.
That's right. That's right. So how did you get, I know your whole family is actually pretty musical. How did you get your start in music?
You know, I really attribute it to being raised on classic country music. And my family would hop in a fake wood paneled station wagon
mm-hmm.
and go south to Florida for vacation every year. And me being the youngest, my two older, my brother and sister would be in the middle of the station wagon uh-huh. singing Beatles songs, and they mm-hmm. harmonized beautifully.
Oh. Mm.
And so I learned how to harmonize listening to them sing
mm-hmm.
and kind of developed a love for playing music. My brother actually had a electric guitar. You know, his room's like across the hall from me. He had
right.
an electric guitar with no amp. So I would just listen to him in there plucking that thing with no electricity coming out of it, but I could understand the chords. And he finally taught me the chords, which I had this little pawn shop acoustic guitar.
Right.
And so I'd come home from high school between school and basketball practice, mm-hmm. and for an hour I'd play Charlie Daniels and John Prine and all these roots guys and southern rock music, just listening to the album.
Right.
You know, this was way before YouTube. Anymore, yeah. You can learn to play guitar in a few months on YouTube.
Right.
And so that's kind of how I got into it.
Well, you can, I mean, and I know from experience, because we've been friends for
22, 3 years.
Yeah. Yeah, because it was not too long after my husband and I got married. We've been married just 25 years. Yeah. But when I moved from...
I dated by my youngest son, kid. Noah, who's 22, and that's mm-hmm. about the time we...
He was a little baby and still in a hand carrier when I met Wendy. That's right, your wife. And both of y'all have joined me in this law firm, and we'll get to that in just a sec. But I do, yeah, it has been about 22 years. Speaking of which, when I first met you and Wendy, it was when I had left Knoxville, where I went to school, law school, and moved to Nashville. And I tell people all the time that Nashville then reminds me of like how and where Colorado Springs is now, just in terms of kind of growth and development. Mm. And there were things going on in Nashville, but it wasn't anything like it is now. But we've been here about 9 years, and how Colorado Springs has changed in the last 9 years is where I can see that growth trajectory. And they're both, I mean, the most wonderful places to be and live. And but I will say, coming into the airport there, I guess it was Friday night, and you know, taking y'all an hour or so to get in to pick me up from the baggage claim. Yeah. And I was asking you, what in the heck is going on here? And they're like, everyone's flying in to go out to Broadway. And I'm like, good night. I can live without that.
And it's grown a lot faster than we've been able to make roads to drive everybody around. So I would just say to visitors from Colorado Springs or wherever, to don't plan to do a lot of driving around, you know, just be prepared to do Uber and that sort
of
thing.
Isn't there a train or something now too, or some kind of train?
Not yet. They've toyed with that idea for a while.
Okay.
There's a couple of little train segments, but they're on the east side of town. They don't really serve downtown well anyway.
Okay. Well, I just know I'd seen something where someone's talking about a train.
I should have mentioned festivals.
Okay.
You know, we have, you know, the beer festival. We have the bourbon festival. Hot chicken festival.
That's right.
You name it, we got a festival for it.
Right. Yeah. And
so come see us, y'all.
Come see us. Come see us for sure. You are tuned in to another brighter day in the neighborhood. I'm your host, Angela Jones, and we're joined today by Paul Rutherford. So, Paul, let's talk about what got you interested in practicing law.
Well, some would say that I didn't have much choice in that my grandfather, my great uncle, about four uncles, my father, my much older brother, and a slew of cousins practiced law before I went to law school.
Mm-hmm.
But I did not head that way initially. I became a social worker.
Mm-hmm.
Working for children, basically. Mm-hmm. And I still sort of consider myself a glorified social worker, even though I've been practicing law now for over 31 years.
Mm.
I sort of view myself more of a social worker than a litigator, even though I did that.
Yeah, of course.
So you asked me, why did I get into it?
Yeah.
I really figured out before long, pursuing psychology and social work, that I could accomplish more and do more have more impact as a lawyer than a therapist or a social worker.
And you and I share that in common. I had that I don't really know that it was an epiphany per se, but when I was at Austin Peay, and you went to Austin Peay.
I did, also, alma mater.
That's right. When I was at Austin Peay and I was in the social work program there, I was heading into the practicum, and I talked to my advisor there, and I was just saying, I'm like, you know, all I can do is lay out options. I can't even tell these folks what to do, and they want you to tell them what to do. And he said, well, you know, that's not what social workers do. But what you might be interested in is going to law school, because that's exactly what lawyers do. And the only lawyer I'd ever had any real interaction with was, you know, a divorce attorney. And I'm not going to mention his name, but he wasn't a very attentive or helpful divorce attorney. And so it got a real bad taste in my mouth.
Yeah, it didn't really hook you in or draw you at that point in time.
Well, he actually scared me to death because he was non-responsive. He didn't show up to court prepared. Mm-hmm. He gave me bad advice, you know, at a variety of junctures, just because he wasn't really invested, you know, in the well-being, my well-being, I think, nor the well-being of my mm-hmm. son. And so, you know, and he might look at it very differently, but that was the impression I walked away with. So I went on to law school. I got a scholarship, went to law school, and ended up at a large firm because I'd done well at law school. But I found it, you know, kind of soul killing. And it is about that time when I first started working at the larger law firm that I met Wendy, and you guys were doing the family law thing. And I ended up 2-3 years in, staying at home with Will, having Will, and coming in and helping y'all on some family law mm-hmm. cases that were a little more complicated, had a little bit more volume.
Interestingly, one of them had a Colorado connection.
That's right. That's right. But just pitching in on those cases, like bringing that expertise that I had at working large litigation cases and marshaling documents and more complex financials on a couple cases with y'all. And for me, it was sort of, it made a lot of sense. And so when I got a chance later on to kind of go back to practicing law after my kids were almost grown, then that's what I started doing family law when I could have done, you know, other things. So
yeah, and you've, with Brighter Day, you've really created quite a little environment of professionalism, a culture of family, everybody kind of treating each other as family, supporting each mm-hmm. other, but also a high quality of, you know, professionalism. I know I've put my foot in my mouth a couple of times. It didn't take long for folks to say, oh, no, Paul, we don't do it like that around here. So I'm learning. We'll get there. But I'm really looking forward to plugging in a substantial way once we get our feet solidly on the ground.
So let's talk about, I know you know, across the, we're a family focused law firm, and that can mean a lot of different things. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times people think, oh, that's custody or that's divorce, but it spans more than that. So talk with me about the parts of serving families that resonates most with you.
Well, I mean, what your average family will intersect with a lawyer in 4 or 5 different ways. There may be some kind of family litigation. It may be a grandkid, mm-hmm. maybe a neighbor's daughter,
mm-hmm.
Or it may be your own kid or mm-hmm. your spouse. I mean, obviously those things come into play. But also, you know, as the baby boomers are passing on or retiring, at least mm-hmm. you've got wills and estates that have to be prepared and dealt with, you know,
right.
Mom passes on and you've got to deal with their will. And mm-hmm. and so I've done that for 31 years.
Right.
I really enjoy working with families that are trying to navigate that process, because if you're not careful, it can become unnecessarily adversarial,
mm-hmm.
and that's nobody benefits from that.
Mm-hmm.
So that happens. I mean, there may be maybe your teenage kid gets into an accident or something. We need mm-hmm. to deal with an accident case. Maybe
right.
somebody's hurt. you know, hopefully not. But so all of those realms.
I know you do some adoptions.
Yeah, no doubt. My wife and I, and I'll just give her a little plug right now. She, in my opinion, is one of the top five adoption lawyers in Tennessee. Mm. And I don't say that for any other reason than it's true. She's got a really keen legal mind. Mm-hmm. She remembers all of those stacks and stacks of statutes. Adoption law is very statutory, meaning it's technical. It's not common law.
Yeah.
And if you don't know those statutes, you're going to run afoul and get taken advantage of or get in trouble. So she is just on top of all of that, very adept at it. She sort of specializes in it. I do it too. She and I sort of fell into it almost accidentally, handling an adoption case 10, 15 years ago, where the law was changing and we had to all of a sudden really become very conversant in this new law. And the case came out successfully, and it sort of catapulted us into doing a lot of adoption law, really contested adoption work.
Right. And your first child was adopted. Y'all adopted Tom?
We got Tom when he was 10 years old. For confidential reasons, I'm not going to go into a lot of detail there,
sure,
but I will say that it was a very fascinating and challenging first 2 years with him. After those 2 years, the state was not able to find anyone to adopt him. I mean, at 12 years old, there's not a huge market for people trying to adopt. And we're in church one morning, and all of a sudden, you know, I just got this overwhelming sense that we needed to adopt him, which our role at that time was just to foster him and give him a home until he could be adopted. But no, something changed that morning. And my wife, what's wrong? You know, and so we talk about it. Next thing you know, we're adopting him. And we joke about it. It's the hardest and the best thing we've ever done, adopting that boy.
Well, and I got to tell you, I sure am glad you did. I love me some Thomas Rutherford.
He's a great kid.
He's the smartest guy. Oh my goodness, something else.
He really is.
Well, Paul, we've just about run out of time. I just am so pleased to have had you here with me today, but more so to have you in the Brighter Day Law family. And I look forward to, you know, of course, all the years we've had as friends, years and years to come, getting closer professionally and working with you there.
Thank you, Angel. It's a pleasure to be here and with Brighter Day.
And thank you all for joining us this bright morning. We are here at the same time and place each week. So join us again whenever you can. And until then, have a brighter day.